This is Edward Jensen, host of the Downtown Phoenix podcast, and it's great to have you here. You've probably read the news online on our website that this is the last episode of the podcast. And while we are sad to see it stop, when we were thinking about our mission at the podcast and what we are trying to accomplish in Phoenix, to educate and inform people on actual urban issues through the lens of the Urban Academy, it's probably best accomplished through other means. When we set out to do the podcast, we had one objective: to create a grand space for dialogue and action on issues vital to the urban resurgence and renaissance in Phoenix. Our conversation set out to be in very high quality and something that made accessible the issues facing our community. After an 8-episode initial run, it became evident that while the podcast is a great project and whose reception surpassed our wildest expectations, there are different and more creative ways to advance our mission of making Phoenix the serious city. So, to that end, our presenting firm, Edward Jensen Urban Productions, is working with community leaders and members of the Urban Academy on a new initiative. While we can't share too many details of that project at this moment, the work of the podcast will certainly inform our work both here in Phoenix and wherever this new experiment goes. Rest assured that the Urban Book Club is still happening, and we will share some news both on our website and our Facebook page, facebook.com/downtownphoenixpodcast, when we have a venue and specific meeting dates. We will keep our current set of episodes online through at least the end of 2014 and probably longer than that. Our website, downtownphoenixpodcast.com, will continue to be updated with news about this and our kindred projects. Do stay subscribed to the podcast's feed in iTunes or whatever podcast receiving app you use, because we will be releasing small vignettes and announcements as required there. So, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for your support of the podcast, and stay tuned for what is to come. We are excited, and we hope that you will be too. Now, because we promised you, and because we think this sets a stage for our work to come, here's a replay in total of the conversation we had with John Talton, the former Arizona Republic columnist and current Seattle Times economics columnist, also an author of the Mapstone Mysteries, and also known as the Rogue columnist, from March. On your Rogue columnist blog, you write a regular series of posts called Phoenix 101. Just explain briefly to the listeners what that is and what some of the more popular posts from that series have been.
When I was a columnist at the Republic, I believe I was the only columnist who had really deep Arizona roots. I go back 4 generations. And one of the things that I tried to bring to my column was a sense of Arizona and Phoenix history. And I began writing Phoenix 101 as kind of a basic history tutorial, but it's not boring, that could go down easy like a spoonful of sugar, so that people would understand that even if they had just moved there from Minnesota and the houses looked brand new and there was a Walmart across the street and they thought there's no history there, that actually the history goes back thousands of years, and that the history of even the city settled by the Anglos has incredibly interesting stories.
What are some of the columns that you've written as part of Phoenix 101, and some of the more popular columns?
Well, one of the more popular ones is called Phoenix 101, The Old City, which is kind of an impressionistic view of Phoenix circa 1960, when you still had a great downtown, but you also had this wonderful oasis of real neighborhoods, and then the acreages spreading out back in those days, what was the far north, like 7th Avenue and Glendale, where my great aunt had an acreage. And another is a series I did called What Killed Downtown, and it's 3 parts, and it takes it from the 1940s up to the downtown revival of now, and looks at what killed downtown, efforts to revive it, and then where we stand now, which is, I think, is the best position we've been in since the 60s. That is important because if we can't understand where we came from, then we can't really understand the way forward. But for whatever reason, that one has been very popular. I actually worked as an emergency medical technician and paramedic for 4 years, partly while I was going through college, and most of this was in downtown Phoenix. And so I wrote a Phoenix 101 that is just called, I believe, Ambulance Days. And that is a lot of personal recollections, but it's also the way that the city was in the 1970s. And that one has been one of the most popular ones. I've written on personalities and people like Barry Goldwater. I've written on decades like the 1960s. All of these have been popular. And one of the more gratifying things are the emails from people who say, I never knew that. I never knew Phoenix had that kind of history. I didn't know Phoenix had a real downtown at one time. I didn't know that Central Avenue was this really cool strip. I didn't realize that Phoenix was this mob-infested town. One of the really popular ones is called Phoenix 101 Underworld on Rogue Columnist, and it talks about how our conceit was that the mob was down in Tucson with Joe Bonanno and the Purple Gang from Detroit, but in fact, there was an FBI study done in the late 50s, and Phoenix had more mobsters per capita than New York City.
Wow, that's certainly gives one pause for a little bit. You mentioned in your response about Phoenix is in the best possible position, in your view, for downtown, or downtown is in its best possible position. And I'm reminded of the George Santayana quotation about those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. In your lifelong observation of Phoenix, John, are there any certain projects or certain initiatives from today or from recent history that this quotation certainly rings true?
Well, this one rings true for a bunch of them, and so does Mark Twain's quote where he says something to the effect of history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. And so Phoenix has grown ever more dependent upon real estate. People can't imagine a time when this was an economy mostly based on farming and large-scale agriculture. Or it was a time when we had a much more diverse economy and a more technology-based economy than today. Or we had locally based banks, all of those things. And so to the extent that any project is rolled out strictly as a real estate project, it almost always holds the fruits of disappointment. So a couple of years ago, out the windows of my condo here in Seattle, there were 7 cranes at work, and now there are 7 skyscrapers. And those weren't built on spec. They were built because Amazon's headquarters is here. And so one of the problems with Phoenix has been this hollowing out, the loss of local headquarters, the loss of major headquarters, and more of these real estate hustles. So you can go back and look in the late 1970s. The original McDonald's was just south of Indian School on Central, and this is in Midtown, admittedly, not downtown. There was a plan to build a skyscraper there. And so eventually they leveled that lot that had this fabulous McDonald's with all that history. There's still not a skyscraper there. There's hardly any parcel on North Central that has not been gamed at one point or another for a skyscraper. There was going to be the tallest building in America, if not the world, in Midtown, and a monorail running to Sky Harbor Airport, and that went to nothing because, again, it was just a real estate play. It didn't have a major corporate headquarters behind it. When we had the Mercado with Fife Symington behind it. You know, not a bad idea. It's just that it was hard to get people who have suburban values as opposed to urban values to come downtown. Arizona Center did a little better for a while, but in many cases you had the same problem. We finally are in a situation where there is somewhat of a critical mass. We have to understand the headwinds that downtown Phoenix faces. There's been a lot of progress made. People need to feel good about it. The people in the resistance, as I call them, who really fight at the grassroots level for a great downtown, need to feel good about it. But they also have to understand this is the nation's sixth largest city, and it's competing for talent and capital that can go anywhere. And the young talent and most of the capital goes to the cool, dense cities. And Phoenix has to get its arms around that and not be defensive about it.
One of those, we certainly have observed that in recent years. A lot of Phoenix, and especially downtown Phoenix, has lost out on economic development opportunities to other states, but also to other cities within the Phoenix metropolitan area. You know, recent examples I think everybody knows include the Apple Display Factory to East Mesa and State Farm and USA Basketball to downtown Tempe. What are some policy prescriptions that you might offer, John, on making those economic development opportunities come back to downtown Phoenix as opposed to outlying areas?
Well, one thing is a very brief history lesson, and that is in the late 80s especially, there was a frenzy to build skyscrapers along Central Avenue, where they really never should have been zoned that way in the first place. And so the real estate players, what I call the real estate industrial complex, went all in to build all these skyscrapers, and many of them were absolutely ruined in the recession of 1990-91, which was the worst thing Phoenix had experienced since the 1930s. And after that point, they abandoned Central Phoenix, and the all-important people who handle leasing for commercial and industrial leasing wanted nothing more to do with Phoenix. The closest thing they wanted to get to Phoenix was 24th and Camelback and the Camelback corridor going into Scottsdale. And then the second thing is that a lot of what drives the real estate plays in Phoenix is not demand in the sense that we have locally headquartered companies or we're growing an economy based on all these different areas, but it's kind of spec building. And so you have to have the major developers and real estate players, especially in the leasing side, on your side. And Phoenix has not had that. And so you've seen these major law firms move inexplicably to me, you know, away from the courts and out to 24th and Camelback. Well, part of that is because City Council allowed them to zone up, although not as high as they wanted to go, the Esplanade and these other buildings, and again, get as close to Scottsdale as possible, get as far away from downtown, and in their minds, the brown people as possible, and then cheap greenfield land. And this is what we see going on in quote-unquote Mesa. And this is no disrespect to my friend Scott Smith, who's been an excellent mayor of Mesa, but most of this is not happening in what we would really consider Mesa. Most of this is happening in the former GM Proving Grounds, which are on the edge of Mesa. And they have behind them very powerful developer friends like my friend Drew Brown at DMB. Not a bad guy at all. It's just the only way he knows how to make money is on the fringes. Verado is an example. And Eastmark, where the allegedly Apple place with heavy incentives is going to go. And I don't know how you get these people to care about downtown because they don't get it. They don't have urban values. I go back to when I lived in Denver, and They wanted to tear down the warehouses and the fabulous old buildings that made up LODO, Lower Downtown, and it was just barely stopped. And it was partly stopped by leadership from the mayor's office, Federico Pena, and Wellington Webb, and it was also stopped because you had a cadre of developers like Dana Crawford who really got urban. So the only reason you have One Lexington, which is a great condo on North Central, again in Midtown, is because they finally brought in a developer from Vancouver who understood urban. 44 Monroe, it's doing okay as rentals, but if they would have had a developer that understood urban and really had capital behind them, they could have done okay. So what needs to happen? Central Phoenix needs to have a dedicated economic development entity, and I know there's supposed to be one, and I don't want to disrespect any of my friends who are a part of that, but it's not doing its job. And this means recruiting outside companies. It means recruiting developers who understand urban issues. It means leveraging all the abundant land and all the closeness to freeways, all the things the Greenfield sites have, but somehow turning them to downtown's advantage, which has been so difficult. It's not going to happen within. It's not going to happen with the people who are running things now, because all they can see is moving farther and farther out on the fringes, leaving things behind. And so that's got to happen. It's going to be very hard. You know, downtown Phoenix ought to be the cheapest, easiest place to do business. But because we really don't have a strong mayor, you know, we essentially have eight other mayors. Any benefit that you give downtown, those eight other mayors are going to want for their districts. And so you've got to prioritize downtown and really go after the economic development aspects. GPEC, no disrespect to my friend Barry Broom, is not going to do it for downtown. It is just not in their DNA.
That's interesting. What are your thoughts, John, on the number of entrepreneurs that are independent entrepreneurs that are opening their doors in some of the co-working spaces in and around downtown? I get it's not the same, are on the same scale and scope as major corporate headquarters, but what are your some of your thoughts on that? These are people who I think have the urban values, if not maybe not the tremendous capital of the other larger organizations.
It would be interesting to see where some of them actually live, but having said that, I know many of them and I love them all, and I'm so glad they're doing what they're doing. This is a really bad time to be an entrepreneur, especially in the retail area, because of Amazon. So here in downtown Seattle, which is one of the best downtowns in America, we're losing these absolutely priceless local retailers because of the Amazon effect. Now, we've got, 20,000 highly paid Amazon employees in the headquarters downtown, so we get the good side of that, but we're losing this fine-grained wonder of locally owned businesses that I was so struck by when I came here in 2007. And so it's going to be even harder in a place like Phoenix. Phoenix has always been capital poor, and the people who have great ideas oftentimes don't have the capital to really put them into place. And the people who have the capital usually don't want to do anything downtown. I mean, if I were rich, I would just want to buy the Gold Spot, and I would put a bookstore in there, and I would spend my days just running that bookstore, and I would be a happy man. But today's rich people don't want to do that. They want to do derivative plays that bounce through Frankfurt and Shanghai and Tokyo and come back and make them a little more money in the casino. These stewards on the small scale are a wonderful thing. I want to emphasize that. They are a wonderful thing. And I admire them, and they are facing tremendous headwinds. But we also have to live in a world of reality if we're going to make real progress. And so what that means is that Phoenix does not have enough private investment on a large scale downtown. And I mean private investment in major jobs. Major corporate headquarters would be especially important. Focusing really with laser beams on building out the downtown biosciences campus and not getting distracted with Mayo and some land play up north. Doing everything we can to help ASU downtown. I know the law school building is not perfect, but it's a building. Build it. Do it. It's saving downtown. So that's one thing. And then another thing is that what Phoenix has lacked over the years since, let's say, the late 70s are the moneyed stewards who can knock heads and write checks. This is something Seattle has. You know, Paul Allen made his money through Microsoft. He could have invested anywhere. He could have invested in crapola suburban subdivisions out on the fringes of Seattle. He didn't do that. He chose to invest in building up the downtown core. He chose to invest right across the street from me in the Cinerama Theater, which he rehabilitated, and it's a showpiece. That's what you get with civic stewards. Phoenix wouldn't have anything that it began with if it hadn't been for the civic stewards that started to die off in the 60s and 70s, and they really haven't been replaced. So if I could wave a magic wand, we would have millionaires and billionaires who would, say, build a symphony hall downtown, that they would buy the lot on the northwest corner of Central and McDowell and make it a sculpture garden that is connected to the Phoenix Art Museum. This is the kind of stewardship that any major city depends upon and that Phoenix is starved for.
You bring up a couple major or contemporary projects that are happening in downtown. So I just want to get your observation on some of these projects. Let's first touch base on the biomedical complex, especially in light of the Mayo hospitals getting involved. What were your assessment of that project as it stands right now, John?
Well, it's moved very, very slowly. I was the first advocate in the media to really push for getting TGen and the International Genomics Institution to come to Phoenix. I wrote numerous columns about this. I wrote a column as an open letter to Jeff Trent saying, as one native to another, it's so important to come back home. You know, Jeff and I became friends once he came there with TGen, and he told me how much that column influenced his decision to locate to Phoenix. But having done that, we have moved so slowly. Phoenix tends to benchmark itself against itself and say, gee, we built more houses last year than the year before, so we're doing great. But we have to benchmark ourselves against the real cities competing for talent and capital. And if you look at the Mission Bay campus of the University of California at San Francisco, they got going at about the same time as the downtown Phoenix Biosciences Biomedical Campus. It's built out to an astonishing degree. And I mean it was built out to an astonishing degree 5 years ago or 7 years ago. So the biosciences campus is behind. It has very formidable competition, but that's where the focus needs to be. One of the problems with Phoenix and Arizona is that everything has to be some real estate hustle. So it's always got to be separated by miles and miles and miles where everybody can only get there by individual car trips. You've got to focus to get critical mass, and this is close to light rail. I think it is a mistake to encourage ASU to put a medical school up by Mayo because that is not accessible by public transit. It will just add to the carbon footprint, and it will just, again, pull the city apart. I mean, you look politically and within the values that people hold, and the vast majority of the people north of the real Salt River Valley proper do not even consider themselves part of Phoenix. So I understand politically why Greg Stanton is doing what he's doing, but the focus really ought to be on going vertical on the downtown biosciences campus and getting a critical mass of talent and research, and then drawing in private sector investment. And the private sector investment ought to be on what Mayor Gordon had thrown out just as a kind of a, if I can say it on your podcast, a brain fart, the Opportunity Corridor. But we've got all of this land that has been abandoned. It used to have real productive things on it, all over the light rail route and south of downtown, that could be part of a blue-collar biomedical manufacturing cluster that could be built there if someone would focus on it. You know, Arizona has major advantages in terms of cost and a skilled workforce that could build biomedical devices and products and take this away from California. And this was something I was advocating 8 years ago in the Arizona Republic, more than that. This is a low-hanging fruit that Phoenix could take, but not put out at, you know, where the USAA campus is out in the middle of nowhere, Hell Road and I-17, but in central Phoenix, along the light rail route. And we're not doing it. And so the bioscience campus has been very slow to go. I'm glad it's happening. The same thing with U of A Medical School. That should be, you know, a big deal by now. It should have the College of Pharmacy and all of that. At least it's happening. But Phoenicians and Arizonans need to understand that they're competing against the world. They're not competing against each other, and they're not competing against their own fantasies of, gee, it's sunny, so everything's fine. There's a reason that wages are so low there, and that is one indication that Phoenix is losing this global race for talent and capital.
Another project is the unveiling of the master plan redesign for Hants Park on the 27th. What are some of your...
Shade. I mean, the people who have moved there from the Midwest and have these fantasies about, you know, we should live in the desert, so we should rip out our central Phoenix lawns and our central Phoenix trees and throw down rocks, are vandals. No disrespect, they just don't know any better. Central Phoenix has always been an oasis. There is no real way for a large number of human beings to live in the Sonoran Desert. I mean, they shouldn't be there in the first place. But Central Phoenix has always been an oasis, and what I will measure the value of Hants Park by is, does it remain an oasis? It needs grass. It needs shade trees. Not only does it need these things because they make it actually pleasant, but also because it will help to ameliorate the effects of the local warming of the heat island, much less global warming. I mean, all of Central Phoenix needs far more shade trees, and in strategic areas it needs grass. In other places it just needs dirt. Please don't throw down rocks. And so I was cautiously optimistic by what I saw of the preliminary plan, but I will judge it by the shade from shade trees, ficus, Texas mesquites, whatever throws down real shades, not Palo Verdes, and not these artificial metallic shade structures. And I understand that the part that runs right on top of the freeway, they can't get the tree roots down very well, but they can certainly have planters for a variety of trees. That is absolutely critical. And then the second thing is that the park needs to be safe. It needs to be regularly patrolled. And then the third thing is that you've finally got to get moving on these dead zones around the park that have been that way just inexcusably now for decades. People don't understand that before they rammed that misbegotten freeway through there, there were two parkways, one on Moreland, one on Portland. Both of them were covered with shade trees. They had a road that ran on either side. This was designed during the City Beautiful movement. They had apartments of all eras on either side of them, and middle-class people lived there, and they were delightful in all seasons because you had shade. Since the freeway has come through, thanks to the heroic efforts of the people in Roosevelt and in its story, most of those houses have been reclaimed. I mean, we must never forget that 3,000 irreplaceable historic houses were torn down so that freeway could happen. But we have, for instance, on the north side of the Portland Parkway, pretty much still just dead land. Well, that's inexcusable. And then we have problems on the other side of Central. We've got to find a way to get that land developed, and it's very difficult since we don't have major corporate headquarters and jobs in the Central Core and on light rail.
You mentioned when we were talking about downtown economic development, the presence and the expansions of both the ASU Downtown Phoenix campus and the U of A campus. ASU is building a new, or is proposing to build a new law school building. Many in the downtown community are generally against the building of it for various reasons. What are some of your observations? You've said build the building because it's a building. But just what are your observations, John, on both ASU's presence downtown and U of A's presence and their expanding presence?
Well, they are good things. I mean, one of the things that has made light rail work for more than just hauling poor people around is that you have a campus downtown and you have a campus in Tempe, and people can go between those two campuses. Ideally, you would want to have two or three major corporate headquarters in the Central Core. We used to have a bunch. We used to have Valley National Bank. We used to have Western Savings. We used to have Viad, Dial, Greyhound, that employed thousands of people downtown. All those are gone now. And so you would ideally want those corporate headquarters, not only that had well-paying jobs, but where the CEO went to work, so it really mattered to the CEO what downtown was like. Central newspapers, gone. You know, you can just go on and on and on. These were the stewards that built downtown Phoenix. And so we're in a situation now where, on the one hand, you can say, you know, it's tabula rasa. It's a blank slate. We can do anything we want. And that is a fatal conceit, because we do not have the talent and the capital and the stewards that are flocking to downtown Phoenix. We have a bunch of dreamers like me who, God, if I was a billionaire, I'd do X, Y, and Z. But the blank slate is in many ways a really fatal, fatal misconception. We've torn down so many of the good bones that Phoenix had, and it didn't have that many to start with because, you know, in the Art Deco era, in the City Beautiful movement era, Phoenix had 40 or 60,000 people total. It was a small city, and we've torn down so many of the good bones that we have, or we've disrupted them. or we've thrown down rocks and gravel where they should not be. ASU especially, and to the degree that it's there, the U of A, have really been saving graces, and I'm inclined to give them pretty much almost anything they want, because they don't have to be there. And Tempe would sure like to keep everything that they've got in Tempe. ASU School of Law, the Sandra J. O'Connor College of Law, was built in the 1970s, and I was told that it's taking like $700,000 a year to keep it up. You know, great 1970s architecture. And so they need to get out of there. That Michael Crow has chosen to put it in downtown Phoenix, kind of like the School of Journalism and Mass Communications, the Cronkite School, is a gift to Phoenix, and we downtown advocates should not form our usual circular firing squad here. Would I have liked it if the old Sahara Ramada Hotel had been kept and rehabbed to its mid-century glory? Yes. But it's gone. It's a parking lot now. And so is what they're putting there the ideal multi-entry point urban setting with all of these retailers downstairs? No. But number one, we don't have all these retailers. We have too many restaurants as it is, and we don't have enough capital to have a lot of other kinds of retail. And number two, you know, come to a city like Seattle, which has a great downtown, and you'll see a lot of buildings that are even worse than that one. And I don't mean to damn it by faint praise. The renderings I've seen are pretty good. And again, you want to start to build critical mass where there will be people. And so I don't think that the perfect should be the enemy of the good.
There's been conversation in the past couple of years about expanding light rail to go south on Central Avenue and out west along Interstate 10 past the state capitol. Your views on light rail are very well known. The shortcoming to a lot of people in this community in downtown Phoenix is that the South Central Light Rail does not run into South Mountain Park. What are your thoughts on light rail in general, and specifically South Central Avenue light rail?
Well, one of the reasons I was forced out of my job as a columnist was my untiring advocacy of light rail. And so for all the people who say he's so negative, he's never in favor of anything, well, I was in favor of a lot of things, and that was one of them. And that's one of the reasons it was built, was that I just kept hammering that and trying to instruct people that this is not some exotic, strange thing, that it works almost every place it's tried around the world. And indeed, it has in Phoenix, and the world hasn't come to an end. Now, let me make a couple of differentiations. We need to expand the light rail system. The west expansion through the capital area will be a really good move, because you'll get the sweet spot of state capital employees, and then go out to, I don't know, where does it go, 75th Avenue or
yeah.
something like that.
79th Avenue, the 79th Ave park
yeah.
and ride.
And so you will actually get a new commuter class, and it'll be a very smart move, and that should be fast-tracked, and I'm all for it. The south line, I think, is missing a critical opportunity if it does not go south and stop at 3rd Avenue and Union Station, 3rd Avenue and Harrison. Go by there so that in the future, when you have commuter rail go to Union Station, you can buy that building back. It's one of Phoenix's real treasures. And you can have a light rail connection to commuter rail at Union Station, and then go south. Does it need to go on South Mountain Park? I don't think it has to. I think it can connect with a circulator bus and be just fine. because most of the reason that you want that south route is for the population of South Phoenix that right now is cut off from job opportunities because of a lack of decent transit. And so it's a start. In all of these cases, it's a start. But another point I want to make is that light rail is not an answer for everything. One of the things that is strange about Phoenix and shows the pathologies at work is that light rail has not attracted very much investment and very much transit-oriented development. You look at the Seattle Starter Line, and there's tons of new apartments and condos and commercial developments that are all along the light rail line running south out of downtown to the airport in Seattle. And that's because you have urban developers who have urban skills and urban demand, and it's doing quite well. That's not happening in Phoenix yet, but it will someday. But for longer distances, you need heavy rail, and heavy rail is commuter rail. Denver is doing a great job of building a balanced system of light rail and heavy rail. And so, you know, we ought to have heavy rail coming in from Buckeye and Goodyear and Tolleson and Avondale. We ought to have light rail coming down on the old Santa Fe line from Surprise and Peoria and Glendale into Central Phoenix. And then we ought to have commuter heavy rail coming in from the Far East Valley, from places like Chandler and Queen Creek and Gilbert, again, into Central Phoenix, into Union Station, and then from there with very convenient transit options out of there to other places. You need to have both. I mean, you know, Seattle has light rail, but Seattle also has heavy rail that is called the Sounder. San Diego has a fabulous combination of light rail and heavy rail. L.A. does too. Dallas does. So we need both, and we're way behind. So I want to get people beyond this thinking of, well, let's expand light rail to X, because X might really be better served by commuter rail than light rail.
Moving topics a little bit, we've seen recently the fallout from Senate Bill 1062, a state legislation that adversely impacted Phoenix or Arizona cities, including Phoenix, and that really raised the question. And from your viewpoint, John, as a longtime Phoenix observer, is the political relationship that the city of Phoenix has with the state of Arizona, is it at a nadir, or is it the same as it always has been?
No, it is absolutely at a low point, and it has been for a few years. But there was a time, of course, when before the, quote, one-man, one-vote ruling of the Supreme Court, that the old bulls of the Senate that were from places like Yuma County or Gila County, they exercised undue influence in the state legislature, and they didn't want to fund no universities because those boys needed to go into the mines or into the fields, and they didn't need no learning. But then after one man, one vote, Phoenix had not only a lot of sway in the legislature with people like Betty Adams Rockwell, but there was a real unified voice of the Phoenix delegation about the good of the city and ensuring that that was seen through the state legislature. That started to fall apart at toward the end of the 1990s as the Republicans started to cull out their supposed rhinos, who were actually the smartest and best legislators. And, you know, Sue Girard is a great example. And Phoenix also annexed way more than it should have, so now you have a big part of Phoenix that really doesn't consider it part of Phoenix. You have a big part of Phoenix that considers itself really Scottsdale or the East Valley. You have another big part of Phoenix that considers itself, I don't know, South Anthem. But they don't really share the values of the old city, And this is shown in the Phoenix legislative delegation. They do not carry with the water for City Hall, and that's really the wrong way to put it. They don't take the things that are important for the city and try to enact them in the legislature. One thing that would be so helpful for the Central Core would be tax increment financing, so that the taxes collected in downtown or midtown could then a big portion of that could then be used to reinvest in downtown or midtown. This is the reason that downtown San Diego was turned around, was tax increment financing. That was a big reason. Another reason was the civic steward like Ernest Hahn, who built the big mall downtown. But that's not the case anymore. And so you have, first of all, what I call the kookocracy, which is this, Tea Party legislature majority, even before the Tea Party was coined, that is anti-urban. It is anti-intellectual, meaning anti-book learning, anti-culture, anti-universities, anti-transit. You know, transit and light rail is some communist plan. They really believe this. And so they are not only indifferent, but they are actually hostile. They're much worse than the old bulls back in the day. You know, Senator Gist, who just wanted to get as much as he could for his district in Yuma. These people are ideologically predisposed against cities, and then they can break off these suburbs that just want to live car-dependent lives and keep the status quo going. And it's very toxic, very poisonous. It's one of the things that doesn't just hurt downtown, but it keeps Arizona behind in building a really quality economy.
Would you say, John, that the relationship that Phoenix has with Arizona is equal to or much worse or maybe a little better than, you know, some other relationships between the big city in a state and that state? I think of like Chicago and Illinois. I think of, you know, Dallas or Houston and Texas. Compare Phoenix to Phoenix as large city in the state to other large cities and their state legislature.
I think the biggest difference is that Phoenix has a lot of people, but those other cities have a huge ecosystem, if you will, of major companies, of very rich civic stewards, of great bones, all of which that give those cities tremendous power beyond the political. They have political power, but even beyond that, they have tremendous power that Phoenix simply does not have. You know, the model in Arizona that was at work in the 1960s, which was you bring people in with sunshine and swimming pools and you just keep building houses, has become even more pathological now than it was then, because then there was a more diverse economy. There was a more diverse economy even in the 1990s. Well, almost all of the headquarters have moved out of Phoenix, certainly out of downtown. The metro area is mostly a back office town. There are very few civic stewards. You know, people say, oh, have you been to the musical instrument museum? And I say, no. You know, it's not downtown. It's not in the museum district. It's not in a public space. It was built by a guy out in a place where it's all private property and you can't get to it except by a car trip. And so it's deliberately kind of anti-urban. I'm sure it was all meant well, but so these are the kind of headwinds that Phoenix faces. It is not just that the legislature is anti-Phoenix and anti-urban. It is. And it's not just that Phoenix itself is divided, where you have, like, Sal DeSicchio's district would really rather be in the East Valley and Scottsdale than be a part of Phoenix. It's not even those two things. It is the fact that Central Phoenix has been denuded of the kind of economic assets that these other cities have in their central cores. There is simply no other city in America of Phoenix's size that has been so clear-cut of its economic heft and its civic stewards and its importance as an economic center as has happened in Phoenix. And none of this is to say anything bad about the good things that are happening there. It's just that a reality check is strength. It's you are stronger if you know where you stand rather than living in this dream world and saying, oh my God, we got another restaurant downtown. Life is great.
Last question for you, John. The editorial direction of this project, the Downtown Phoenix podcast, is that we are a podcast of action. We're a program, a toolkit for people to get involved in making their communities better. What are some of the best ways in your observations of Phoenix, your experience both being here in Phoenix and writing about it, both here and from afar? What are some of the best ways for people to get involved in this place, to make this city better and to make its leadership more responsible to its citizens?
Well, I think one thing would be that every dollar you spend is a vote you cast. So, I mean, I still have a condo in Central Phoenix, and I never spend money in Scottsdale. No disrespect to Scottsdale. I only spend my money in Central Phoenix. And when I lived in Willow, it was the same thing. And, yes, absolutely, to the extent you can, and I can't because I'm a journalist, but to the extent that you can, you need to show up at meetings and make your voice heard and write your council members and certainly vote. Where we're having districts decided by a 22% turnout, it's absolutely outrageous. Inform yourself on the issues. Certainly learn about best practices in other cities. On Rogue Columnist, there's a page called the City Desk, and that page is entirely devoted to best practices and urban issues in other cities. It's not going to hurt us as Phoenicians to learn what's going on other places. In fact, we have to do that so that we can get a sense of what will be needed for our admittedly special circumstances. And I think that it's important to have really serious metrics and, you know, really hold to them. How many employees are downtown in the private sector? Is it growing or is it shrinking? And how are we measuring that? And then using best practices, how can we turn it around? And then the last thing is we've got to have two more emotional speeds than two. Right now, the typical Phoenician has two emotional speeds. It's either irrational optimism or suicidal depression. And neither one of those are helpful. Downtown's a lot better than it was in 1980. It's not a lot better than it was in 1960. It's not where it has to be to attract the young talent and the capital that is going to Denver, a Portland, a Seattle, a San Diego, even a San Antonio. That's not running down Phoenix. It's just you got to know where you stand. And so I just always encourage people to get a lot of different emotional gears there because this is a long march. This is a long fight to encourage people with urban values in a place that doesn't have too many high-paying jobs to try to stick it out, and please plant shade trees.
He's John Telton. He's the Rogue columnist. He's also the Seattle Times economics columnist. John, thanks for spending some time with us tonight.
Ever, it was my pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks to John Telton for appearing again on the Downtown Phoenix podcast. Okay, that was actually recorded back in March 2014. And thanks to you for listening to the Downtown Phoenix podcast. On that note, that will wrap up the Downtown Phoenix podcast for now, and thank you for making this a part of your advocacy toolkit, and for joining us along for this media experiment. You can stay up to date on some of the projects that we will still be working on at our website, downtownphoenixpodcast.com, and on our Facebook page, facebook.com/downtownphoenixpodcast. My thanks to all of our guests who have appeared on the podcast, whose conversations have enlightened us and have called us to action and have reminded us of the power of this community, of this place that we call home. And my thanks to Downtown Phoenix Partnership and Downtown Phoenix, Inc. for providing a physical space for the podcast as we recorded our first and only series. Well, only series for now. We reserve the right to come back later on. So, thank you once again for listening. We will be back in a different form, destination and date unknown. This has been the Downtown Phoenix Podcast. I am Edward Jensen, and this has been an Edward Jensen Urban Production.